Now think to yourself that it is for the benefit of all of our mothers, all sentient beings who are as limitless as space, that we need to attain Buddhahood. And in order to attain Buddhahood, we need to practice the Dharma. And in order to practice the Dharma, we also need to know what's going on. We need to listen and contemplate to the Dharma. So think to yourself that this is the reason why you are listening to these teachings this afternoon. And the Dharma that we are listening to is the presentation of karma as made in the fourth chapter of Vasubandhu's Treasury of Abhidharma. And so this morning we started talking about karma, what it is. We talked about a little bit about the motivations, the instigators and the executors, right? The causal and contemporaneous motivations. And then we started talking about the various different types of karma. And talking about the various different types of karma, here we have primarily been talking about karma in terms of what kind of a result does it make? What is the sort of fully ripened result that it makes? You know, is it a good result, a bad result? So merit, non-merit, unmoving, the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral karma, or so forth. So we've been primarily talking about karma in terms of the result that we experience from it. Now, we haven't quite finished that section yet. We've still got a little bit more to go on that. And here we've come to verse 57 on the handout, on the page 2 of the handout, for those of you who weren't here. Basically, when we talk about the full ripening of karma, well, you might wonder, what is it? We said that full ripening is basically feelings, right? And so feelings can occur either in our sensory consciousness or they can occur in our mental consciousness, right? So when we do virtuous karma, virtuous acts, where is it that that ripens? So basically, this is what this verse is talking about. And so it says, virtuous karma that is free of considering will fully ripen only as feelings in the mind. What this means, when you have virtuous karma that is free of considering, this is specifically means the karma that we do on when we have the second jhana, the second level of dhyana and higher in terms of the meditational states. So this is a practice that we don't do in the Tibetan tradition. They do it in the Theravada tradition. We don't do it so much. If you attain the second of the four levels of jhana, then you will have the virtuous karma that's free of considering. And that ripens only as a feeling in the mind. So implicitly, what this is saying is that the virtuous karma that we do here in the desire realm, where we have considering and examining, this virtuous karma ripens both as feelings of the body and as feelings of the mind. So, a pleasant experience is a mental feeling, or a pleasant experience that comes out of a tactile sensation or a visual or an auditory sensation, right? So that's what full ripening comes. Right? This is the news of the morning for a lot of you. Like, whoa, full ripening is only this feeling, you know. But this is what it's saying, right? So now, when you have unvirtuous actions, well, how do they ripen? Do they ripen as feelings of the body or as feelings of the mind or as both or something? And what it says here is non-virtue ripens on the body. So the full ripening of non-virtue is only a feeling in your body. It's only the unpleasant body feeling. It is not an unpleasant mental feeling, because that's unhappiness. And unhappiness, either you're unhappy that you did something wrong and you regret it, that's a virtuous feeling, or you're unhappy about something you don't like, and you're indulging in anger or aversion, and that's unvirtuous. So mental unhappiness, as we went through this morning, is always either virtuous or unvirtuous. Right? It's not just neutral. So it's not the result of full ripening. The result of full ripening is just the mere experience, and so it's not virtue or unvirtue. But then we had a wonderful question this morning. Well, what happens when you get depressed. And, you know, depression does come up through physical conditions. There are physical conditions that cause it. And that's exactly what this next verse talks about. It says, a distraught mind is mental mind. It's born from fully ripened karma, from fear or harm, imbalance, sorrow, among the attached, not in the north. So distraught mind, as the commentary explains, means someone who's got something unhealthy. The commentaries explain it primarily as like someone who's just crazed with whatever, you've gone out of your mind, basically, was distraught. But you can also think of it, you know, other mental conditions also, or just a lesser degree, same sort of thing in a lesser degree. And so these can come from the full ripening of karma. So it's an unpleasant feeling that happens in your mind because of the full ripening of karma. That's one way that it can occur. The other way is when you experience fear or harm. It comes out of trauma, in other words. You have some sort of trauma and you get depressed or you get unhappy or distraught or crazed out of it. That's another thing that can cause mental illness, essentially. Imbalance. Imbalance is described as being imbalance in the winds of bile and phlegm and so forth. In other words, medical conditions. So there are medical things that happen. And then sorrow, grief. You've lost someone and you go distraught at having lost someone so important to you. So these are the causes that are presented as bringing about the depression and mental illness. And, you know, if it comes out of imbalance, in other words, if it comes out of physical condition, there are ways, you know, there are medical things that you can do to help it. If it comes out of full ripening, then it's probably something that perhaps there are medicines that will help. But there may not be. If it comes out of fear and sorrow or grief or harm or trauma, then it's probably something you have to deal with. You know, that's a mental condition. That's not some physical thing. It may have triggered some sort of a physical reaction within your body that then leads to it. But, you know, if you are depressed because your companion of many years has just passed away suddenly and you're alone, then... it's a difficult situation, but it's not necessarily a physical cause to that. So you just, in other words, when you're dealing with depression, mental illness, and that sort of thing, then you have to look at what the actual cause of the specific condition is and deal with it appropriately. And if you're working with other people, then you have to help them find out what the cause is for themselves. And in this society, we use a lot of psychotropic drugs, and if they help someone calm their mind to a point where they can practice virtue, that's good. If the person just gets so happy that they're indulging in greed and desire, then that's maybe not so skillful. You have to look at it on any given level, and I'm not going to tell anyone what to do. You have to just I think it has to be looked at on a case by case basis. Mental suffering is one of our biggest problems in this culture because we've done a pretty good job of decreasing and hiding the physical suffering. So, I hope that addresses your question.
It gives me a lot to think about.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people have tried all of the processes of drugs or therapy and everything and they're still suffering, mental suffering, I'm wondering if there is like purification meditations and things like that may be helpful for an individual.
It's, I think, just doing any spiritual practice at that point can be helpful. If it's someone who's just clearly their mind is gone or their mind is whacked and there's nothing you can do about it, then that sort of person may not be helped in, by trying to do formal meditation. But generally, training in practices, meditation practice, I find for myself that when I get discouraged, that I have found in the past that doing Chen Ruizhi practice is really, really helpful for that. Just because you start thinking about all the problems that all other sentient beings have, and then my own little piddling problems pale in comparison. And I once asked the Gyalong Karmapa, you know, you hear so much about needing to attain Buddhahood in one lifetime, one body. What can we do? But I don't feel like I have that real resolve, and how do we develop that? And what he said was, he didn't answer the question directly. He said, picture yourself on the top of a big hill, and all around you there are all infinite numbers of sentient beings who are all suffering. You can see them all. There are all sorts of animals, people, people you know, people you don't know. And you see them all and meditate on love and compassion. It's like you're on the middle of a hill. It's not like you're in a canyon someplace. It's not like you're on a street in New York City where you can't see them. You're on the top of a hill and you can see all these beings and meditate on how they all want to be happy. And that really, it was really inspiring, you know, actually, to actually think, well, okay, and to try it, you know, and maybe trying that. Getting out of your own mind really helps a lot. So any of the meditation practices that we do. I think if you start going on specific practices, I'm going to do the specific practice for the specific thing, you might have create expectations that are not fulfilled in the way that you expect them to, and the possibility for disappointment. Just start, take it slowly, don't worry. It'll gradually, within a year or two or ten. Take care of itself. And then before they realize it, it may have taken care of themselves. Okay, so that... okay, so that's discussing karma in terms of the results up to this point. We can also talk about karma in terms of the cause. And so that's what the next two lines are about, very short. It says, the crooked, faulty, degenerate are born of deceit, hate, and desire. So when we talk about all those negative things we do, the things that are crooked, that are degenerate, that are faulty or harmful, then we do them out of deceit, which is basically being dishonest. We do them out of hate, and we do them out of desire. So those are the three. So we can think about karma, particularly negative karma, as being motivated by those three. On following this, we talk about karma in terms of both the cause and the result. So this is the combination of, you know, white karmas, black karmas. So white causes and white results, black causes and black results. What's the relation of all of these? And so what it says here, usually we think of this as there's karma that's white, there's karma that's black, and there's karma that, and then what else would you, well, basically we talk about, think about white and black. And when Rinpoche talks about it, he talks about white and black. You may have heard him talk about how you know, you have a white deed leading to a white result, black deed leading to black results, and or you might have a black motivation when you do a deed and have an experience of the difference between the white and the black motivations and the white and black actions. This is a little bit different. This is saying, you know, you have a white deed, a virtuous deed, which produces a virtuous action, a good result. But what are the good ones? Well, we have four different types of karma, as white and black, etc. So we've got white karma, black and white karma, or white and black karma, it says in the text. White and black karma, and then we've got karma that's neither white nor black, right? Four possibilities, right? So white karma, that, when you think about it, white basically means good, positive. So good, positive things that ripens in a completely white, you know, not even a speck of black. What is that? That's basically the karma that ripens in the form and the formless realms, because there's no experience of pain or suffering there. There's the composite suffering, but there's no physical feeling or no mental feeling of pain. So when you do the jhana meditations, those are what we call white karma, white actions, because they have white, completely white results. Then we've got black karma. That's like, you know, You murder your neighbor and you go to hell, basically. You know, the black action that has a black deed. You do a negative action that has a painful result, in other words. So that's the black karma. And then we've got the white and black karma. White and black karma is you do something that's good, but you're still attached to the desire realm. So you've got a mixed motivation. You've got some sort of clinging to yourself, maybe a little bit of craving and greed involved in it. And it ripens as a good result in the desire realm. In other words, where we are now. So we have a good result, like we all have done white and black karma that's got us to this place where we are well-fed, happy, and now that the heat is on, we're warm. You know, we have these pleasant feelings. But, as everyone's been saying, there's lots of mental suffering in this area. So that's white and black karma. It's mixed. Speckled karma, you could say this. They don't say gray, actually. It's white and black, you know. You've got black parts, you've got white parts. It's not checkered. Checkered might be a good word. But I used white and black when I translated it. I thought about saying white, black and white, but then TV sets just popped to mind. So that's basically what this next stanza says. Non-virtue, virtue of form, realm, and of desire, respectively, are karma that is black, white, both. What douses them is undefiled. So the karma, there's the karma that extinguishes, the actions that extinguish all of the other karma. That is the undefiled karma. That is the karma that frees us from samsara. In other words, the karma that can actually eliminate our afflictions and actually free us from the desire realms and the realms of existence. So that's like, in our practice, that's, you know, Mahamudra meditation, real Mahamudra meditation, right? So, I'm going to skip a little bit here I'm going to skip down to the verse 66. The non-virtue of the body, etc., is proposed as the three harmful conducts. You know, that's pretty easy. And, I'll keep going. To covet and so forth, hard action, but are three harmful mental conducts. So here, this is saying, when you talk about, do you all know the 10 non-virtuous actions by heart? Oh, what are the three of... Start. It's easy to take it by... How many of them are by body?
Killing.
Three.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what are they?
Killing.
Stealing. Sexual misconduct. Okay, then what comes next?
Speech.
Okay. Body, speech, mind. Always the same. Okay. So what are... How many of there are speech?
Four.
And what are the four of speech? Lying,
chatter, divisive speech,
menace, chatter,
lying.
I translated it as harsh speech. So, harsh speech, divisive speech, lying, idle chatter. Okay. So, how many have we got left?
Three.
Three. And what are they for?
Mind.
Okay. And so, what are the three of mind?
Wrong views.
Covetousness. Malice. Malice, covetousness. Now, you might have heard different translations of these terms, but basically, covetousness is wanting things. We'll get to that tomorrow, or maybe tonight. We'll see. This afternoon. So we've got covetousness, malice, and wrong views, which are the non-virtues of mind. And here what it's saying is to covet and so forth aren't action, but are three harmful mental conducts. So what this is saying is that covetousness, malice, and wrong view can get you to do wrong things, but they're not actually actions in and of themselves. So we mentioned this morning. In this particular tradition, the Kashmiri Great Exposition tradition, we're saying that action is body and speech, pretty much. It's the body and speech that's important in terms of actually doing the actions. And so, you know, coveting things, being malicious, and having wrong views aren't actually actions of body and speech. So this is following up on that point. In other presentations, if you read the Gateway to Knowledge and other presentations of the Mahayana, then in those, karma is primarily presented as being mental. So that's a difference between the two schools. And so in those presentations, covetousness, wrong view, and malice would also be considered actions as well as being karmic paths or harmful conduct. And so fine conduct is the opposite. So, you know, so it's the virtuous conduct of body and speech. And so it being non-malice, non-greed, non-hatred, things like that. So among them, to consolidate grossly the various virtues and non-virtues are taught as the 10 karmic paths. So we've gone over the 10 karmic paths. We've gone over the 10 unvirtuous karmic paths. Then there are the 10 virtuous karmic paths, which are the opposite. So the opposite of taking life is refraining from taking life, or taking a vow not to take life. The opposite of stealing is refraining from stealing, so having basically a commitment or a vow not to steal, and so forth. Those are the virtuous actions. Another way of looking at it is that the opposite of taking life is to save life. That's another presentation. And here it's primarily the opposite of killing is having a commitment or a vow not to kill. The opposite of stealing is having a commitment or a vow not to steal. And this is actually considered a sort of action. It's what we call an imperceptible form in this school. Not all schools accept that there are imperceptible forms. When you hear this term imperceptible form, it makes it sound like there's some sort of, you know, you take a vow and then there's some sort of imperceptible goop that sort of sticks to you, you know, or you've got some sort of thing on you that's the vow. It's an imperceptible form. But actually, I've been thinking about it recently, and I'm sort of wondering, it's just my own opinion, and I haven't seen it in any text, but I'm wondering if when we say that a vow, like the vow not to kill, is an imperceptible form, it's actually, right now I'm keeping that vow, but there's no perceptible action for it. We talked about actions as being form, right? Like a prostration is a visual form. Same way, I have a vow not to kill, and I'm not killing right now, and I'm also engaging in the restraint from killing. So I've got that action of restraining. And others of you may have that vow as well. So when it talks about imperceptible, that's pretty much what we're saying. There's like some sort of a commitment there. There's some sort of an action. But it's not necessarily that. I'm going to skip verse 67. And 68, the main point, basically, that we have to remember, when we do any of the karmic paths, we've got three aspects for it. You've got the preparation, you've got the actual act, the deed itself, and then you've got the aftermath of the deed. And so, to illustrate with taking life, the moment you get up off your seat, you get your weapon, you go over to the being that you're going to kill, you strike that being once or twice or however many times, that's all preparation. The time that you strike that being and actually kill it, actually take its life, that moment of taking life is the actual act. And then the aftermath is skinning the animal, selling its hide, eating its flesh, and so forth. That's that way. And we can think about it the same way. I mean, you can easily think about it stealing. Going and sidling up behind that person and reaching your fingers into their pocket to pick out their iPhone. Up to that point is, you know, the preparation. When you actually get the iPhone and out of the pocket, that's stealing. And then when you run away so they don't catch you, that's aftermath. And then you're using the iPhone and running up their cell phone bill, right? Yeah.
Now, if somebody buys that stolen item, is that karmic? Is that result of karmic?
It's not a result of karma. The question is that person who's buying it engaging in a negative deed, right? Are they engaging in the stealing? If they don't know that it's a stolen iPhone, then they're not doing anything negative from their perspective. They're just getting caught. But if they know that it's negative, then they're participating in it.
And is the consequence of that action as severe as, you know, stealing it? Or, I mean, are there...
If they're rejoicing in the stealing, they get the whole shebang. Okay.
What if they suspect had stolen it, yet she was not to ask.
That's your own conscience. You know when you look at something. You know when you look at yourself. You have to look. This isn't okay. We're using the stealing the iPhone example. It's a silly example, but maybe it's a real. It is a real example in many instances. But you've got to look for yourself when you are doing your own actions. You've got to look at what your motivation is, and when you find yourself in a potentially ambiguous setting, what is your motivation? That's what you're looking at. Amy?
Well, it's sort of related, this question of intention. Like, let's say I was out hunting. I had this intention to kill a deer, but I wasn't very skillful. And I didn't kill the deer, and the arrow flew off and hit a rabbit who didn't die, but was suffering a lot or something.
Oh, yeah.
So I didn't intend to make that rabbit suffer.
Right, yeah. That's a you get the bad karma of the preparation, but not of the actual deed. Even if you killed the rabbit, you would not have the intention. We'll be getting to that,
okay.
Verse 73. Why don't we go on a little bit, because I think some of these questions... Okay.
So aftermath is different from result.
The result is that the person... the result is that the person doesn't have the iPhone. The aftermath is doing all of the things, you know... Running away and all that. Selling it, you know. So at the end of verse 68, you know, it talks about whether the couple of verses are talking about whether they're perceptible or imperceptible. Let's not worry about that. Basically, when you talk about it, the preparations come from the three roots. So when you're doing a negative deed, when you're doing an unvirtuous act, that comes out of the three roots of non-virtue, which are greed, hatred, and desire. For example, coming out of greed is you are killing Bessie for food, right? Coming out of hatred is when you are killing an enemy. Coming out of deceit is, or coming out of delusion is euthanasia. Like, the example given in the commentaries is of the ancient Persian custom Zoroastrian custom of euthanasia for their parents. But, you know, similar. You bring Fluffy to the vet to put her to sleep. Same thing. So you've got the idea that you want to help someone and you think that killing them is going to help them. So that's coming out of delusion. Or the example in the Vinaya of one nun who, hearing the stories of all the suffering of samsara, decided to poison 60 other nuns so that they wouldn't experience suffering anymore. So, you know, things like that. And so they come right out of the three roots. They follow the three roots immediately. The preparation comes right out of the three root. And so coveting and so forth come from them. So coveting, malice, and wrong view come out of the three roots. Coveting comes out of greed. Malice comes out of aversion and hatred. And wrong view comes out of delusion, right? And so the virtues and the preparations for the virtues and the aftermath of virtuous actions arise from non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion. So that's just sort of thinking about the causes of where these different karmic acts come from. So that's what motivates us to do it. But as we remember, we've got there's the motivation that you have at the moment that you decide to do something. And then there is the motivation that you have at the moment that you actually commit the act, that brings the act to completion, right? So what is it that brings, like with the act of killing, what is it that brings that to completion? So in verse 70, talks about this in a very concise way, in 71. So hatred brings killing and harsh words and malice to completion. So you're going to kill something, at the moment that you're completing the action of killing, then you have to have the hatred because you're wishing harm upon another being, right? And harsh words is speaking badly, saying mean things about people. At the moment that you're saying them, you've got hatred there. And also malice, the same thing. When you have a real fully developed malice, there's an element of hatred in that as well. And here is, I think, the interesting thing that we need to look at. Because we need to look at when we have feelings. In our culture, we don't murder very often anymore. But we do have a lot of harsh speech. Very harsh speech. Actually, American culture is quite remarkable in this. British culture is even worse. British culture, they say a lot of very harsh things about people in very funny and cute ways. Actually, the English language, one of the best things that you, the things that English language is best for is putting people down. It really is. It's a very good language for insulting people and even insulting them in ways that they don't realize they're being insulted. And so we as English speakers have a tendency to do this. And so you need to really look at your motivation when you're thinking about saying that kind of cute but kind of mean thing about someone else, which is something that a lot of us do more frequently than we'd like to admit. So you have to look at your motivation and see really what's going on at that point. Particularly among our sanghas, it's most important. The most important thing you can do for your Dharma practice is get along. And our Trangu Monastery in Nepal is renowned for everyone getting along. And so I hope that this it seems like actually, it seems on a certain level unnecessary to say here, because everyone here seems to get along pretty well. I mean, of course, you know, there are always little things that come up and little frustrations here or there, but looking at it from coming in from time to time here, it seems like people generally do really get along, and that's great. And so when I'm saying this as sort of a watch out for the future thing, not at this sort of thing. It's really important to get along. You can't do anything more important than that. There are so many Buddhist sanghas that you look at, and they're riven apart by some sort of conflict. And a lot of it comes down to harsh words. There are often other things that go on, but a lot of it's just people not liking each other and making it clear. And it's caused a lot of problems for many, many people. So just please do keep it in mind and always try to get along. When someone insults you, it's often either they don't know what they're saying, or often there's a grain of truth to it. For me, when someone criticizes me, my initial reaction is usually to feel somewhat defensive, if not combative. But when I really think about it, there's usually something that's true in their criticism. And so it's best to just be patient, relax, and please try your best to get along. So the end of that digression. So then the next we have, greed brings coveting, adultery, and also stealing to completion. So when you covet something, or when you're greedy for something, or adultery, you know, it's like, that's greed. The word that I translated here with greed covers both greed and lust. So that's what we mean. When I say greed here, it's like greed and lust are really, they're both really wanting something, you know? So wanting pleasure, wanting something that you really like in a way that's out of control. And then wrong view is completed by delusion, and the rest by three. So, lying. What are the rest? Harsh words, killing, malice, greed, coveting, adultery, stealing. So, harsh words, idle chatter, and so forth. And not harsh words, idle words, divisive speech, and lying. Right? And so then the bases, they're sentient beings, enjoyments, name, and form, and worth. So these are basically saying, well, what is it that you do it to? When we say basis here, what we mean is, what is the recipient of the action? So like with killing, the recipient of the action is a human being, or a sentient being, right? With stealing, or with sexual misconduct, it's an enjoyment, something you want and enjoy. With malice, it's name and form. So there was about name and form. And then with the other, with the four of speech, it's all words. So now we come to the fun verse, the one that answers Amy's question. So when killers die before or else together, there's no actual. They've been born in another body. So you might wonder, well, when is it that you actually get? You actually, you know, basically have committed karma and accumulate the karma when the actual act happens. So here, let's take a hypothetical example. Two guys get in a duel. They each wound each other mortally, and they're both lying on the ground, bleeding to death. One dies before the other. The one who's died has passed away before the actual basis of his act of killing is completed. As a result, he doesn't have the actual basis of the killing. He died first. The other guy, he not only does he die, he gets the actual basis of killing, the bad karma. Now, that being said, the preparations for this is, you know, the preparations of killing and the striking and so forth is a pretty horrific thing. So the guy who died isn't much better off, but you sort of wonder about it. And then this is reminding me of something I should have said a couple of minutes ago. It says, you know, when you talk about these 10, there are things like beating people, tearing down houses, and stuff like that that are not included in these 10 karmic paths, right? They're just sort of, these 10 karmic paths aren't saying these are all wrong things. These are just saying, like, these are the ones that are really problematic, the ones that are really bad. Beating people up is also unvirtuous. Tearing people's houses down is also unvirtuous. You know, building houses for people is virtuous, even though it's not really one of the 10, right? So we're not excluding any non-virtue or virtue by just saying that there are these 10, right? Then, in wars, etc., all of them have the same goal, so all possess the karma like the perpetrator. So when you are... So the example here is, if you have a platoon of people that are going out to go to war, one of the people shoots and kills an enemy. All of the people who went out together have the karma of killing, because they all have the same intention. And actually, this is, when you think about the results of this in terms of, like, large-scale warfare, it's pretty horrific, you know. Mm-hmm. Those people in the battles of World War I, where 50,000 people were killed in one day, you know. Just, you know, each of them getting the karma for thousands and thousands of deaths. And you have to think about how far it goes in a military organization. But the basic point is that when you're working together to do something, if one person does something, you all get the karmic result of it. So this is, you know, the wars and hunting. Bunch of guys go out, you go hunting, you're enjoying yourself. You don't kill anything, but your buddy does. You still have the bad karma. You might also think that, okay, I'm going to go... My friends are going fishing, it's fun to hang out with them, but I'm Buddhist, so I'm not going to kill. But if you go, and they kill the fish, and then you have some fried fish yourself, you know, you're getting all the bad karma of killing yourself. It's the same, because you're really working for the same purpose. If you're conscripted, and you go completely against your will, and you don't participate, and you do everything in your power not to participate, even at the cost of your own life, then you don't get the bad karma. But otherwise you do. Similarly, when we all come here and you do a puja, and you're all doing the puja together, you're doing a service together, one person gets up and is the shrine master and makes the actual offering. But everyone's participating, so everyone gets the good karma of doing it. So, this is the thing about karma. We talk about the negative to scare you, but it also works the positive way. And we've got, 10 more minutes. What I'd like to do is go through the next section, which talks about, well, what is each of these karmic paths, the negative karmic paths, because it's important to know this. So, to take life is to kill another intentionally, unerringly. So, taking life is you have to have the actual basis of killing someone, right? You have to do it intentionally. If you are driving down the road and the squirrel runs in front of you and you can't swerve and you end up running it over, you have not got the bad karma of killing the squirrel because you had no intention to kill the squirrel. On the other hand, you're driving down the street, the squirrel runs in front of you and you gun it. Yeah. That's bad. Okay. The third factor is unerringly. So if you plan on killing Dharmadatta, but you kill Devadatta instead, you're okay. You didn't kill. You don't get the bad karma. If Amy goes hunting, shoots at a deer, and kills a rabbit instead, she doesn't have the actual basis of the karma. It's still a bad thing. You've still gone through all the preparations of it, right? But you don't have the actual basis because you've made a mistake. So the three factors. You have to have the actual basis, you have to do it unerringly, and you have to do it intentionally. Yeah, isn't that kind of funny? It's hard to get your mind around.
Yeah.
But you're making a mistake, you know. You weren't intending to kill Devadatta. You were trying to kill Dharmadatta.
But your intention was still to kill.
Your intention was to kill. That's right. You've got all the preparations. You've got the bad karma of the preparations. You do not have the bad karma of the actual deed. Because it isn't what you intended to do. Okay. To steal is to make another's wealth one's own by wealth or thievery. By force or thievery. So mugging or burglary, basically. Or any other sort of way, stealthy way of taking someone else's wealth. And this also, all of these actually also have to be the intentional and the unerring. Then to lie with one who shouldn't be lying with, four kinds of sexual misconduct. So the four kinds of sexual misconduct are to the wrong person, the wrong being, the wrong orifice, the wrong time, and the wrong place. So the wrong person would be a child, your parents, someone who, another person's spouse. The wrong orifice would mean the anus or the mouth. The wrong time is, the wrong time is when, for instance, when a woman is pregnant, or when they're a nursing mother. And the wrong place would be in the open or in a sacred place, like in a shrine room or so forth. Now, this is a hard one for lay people. Particularly, a lot of Westerners have the objections to how can oral sex be unvirtuous? And you have to look at your motivation when you're doing it. Why are you engaging in the act? Pretty much, when we engage in sexual activities, it's almost always out of lust. It's out of an afflicted mind state. Because it's coming from an afflicted mind state, it is a non-virtue, and it's going to have bad results in the future. This is almost every instant of sex. Now, in our society, there are some that are more, you know, there's some types of sexual misconduct that really create a lot of problems. Doing it in the open, doing it with children, doing it with other people's spouses, and so forth. Those are clearly sexual misconduct. But you need to, in order to distinguish whether something is virtuous or unvirtuous, whatever the act may be, you have to look at the mind state that motivates you to do that action. So, but you all are lay people, and so I'm not going to tell you to, you should be celibate. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying you should be very careful, and that you should, because one of the greatest sources of conflict in our relationships comes out of sex, sexual misconduct in particular. So do be careful. Do be careful of your mind states, because you can hurt yourself and hurt others quite severely. So that is the sexual conduct. To say one thing while thinking another one clearly understood is lying. So that's basically, you know, when you're lying to someone, you know that you're thinking something else, but you're trying to trick them, you're telling them something different, and they understand you. If they don't understand what you're saying, you haven't actually managed to tell the lie. it hasn't really connected, right? So you have to be understood, and you have to know that what you're saying is wrong. So divisive speech is words said with an afflicted mind to divide others. So you see people getting along, you get jealous of it, and you say something in order to divide them, right? Harsh speech is words that are unpleasant. So, you know, calling people names or so forth, that's harsh speech. And any afflicted words are chatter. Idle words are words that are, when you speak, you are motivated by the afflictions, greed, delusion, desire, envy, pride, and so forth. Just sort of having a regular banter is not necessarily idle speech then, right? So it's only when it's coming out of the afflictions. And then some say that speech, then there are some other ideas about what afflicted speech is. So afflicted speech that's other than those, you know, they're saying that idle chatter is the afflicted speech other than lying, divisive speech, and harsh speech. Like flattery or song or shows or else bad treatises. Shows and song, they're often, you sing or you dance or something to out of a feeling of attraction, to want to be attractive. And so that's why that is listed here. When you're singing Dharma songs, it's not. Then you're singing to inspire faith and so forth. To covet is wrongly greeting for others' worth. I was so glad that greed can be used as a verb. it actually is in the OED. It's a great resource when you want to use it. So you have greed for someone. You want someone else's things. That's coveting. Malice is hate for sentient beings. So you're basically engaging in hatred. We all know what malice is. And then wrong view. Believing there's no virtue or non-virtue is wrong view. So when we say the wrong view is a karmic path, it's essentially saying, oh, there's no karma or anything like that. There's no rebirth. You can do whatever you want. Doesn't matter. You can enjoy life and have fun. And, you know, whatever you do is fine. You know, that sort of view, that's what we mean by wrong view. And the reason this is so harmful is that when you have that sort of view, then you engage in negative actions that then bring yourself and others bad results. So these three are paths and seven karma too. So the three of mind, we call them karmic paths because they lead you to do unvirtuous things. The other seven, the four of speech and the three of body, are also karmic paths, and they're also karma, actual actions. So I think that's a good stopping place for this afternoon. And we have a minute or two. Let's take two questions before we have tea. Can we? Yes. Is that dangerous? Well, what we have for the rest of the afternoon is tea, and then we have after tea, I've been asked to speak something about Kenshin Trungpa Rinpoche's activities on all the various things that he does, because a lot of you might not know sort of the actual scope of, it's incredible, of what's going on. and so...
Just to clarify that, are we going to bring, our tea in here and then hear this, or like...
Well, what we have time for is we could have questions and responses from the... We could have 15 or 20 more minutes for questions and responses if Chopin wants to, and then we could break for tea and then bring our tea in and...
Let's do 10 minutes for questions, and then we will have 20 minutes to sort of decompress, and then we'll...
We can come back in
with our tea.
Yeah.
We can have your tea.
Yes.
We don't know.
Okay. So let's have questions before the 10 minutes are up. Yes?
In talking about the action, the preparation and the action and the aftermath, if you were to prepare to do something bad and then not do it, you get the karma just for that.
For the preparation, yeah. And that wouldn't provide a ripening result. It would have the sort of the compatible result of, you know, conditioning yourself to be more likely to do that in the future. Mm-hmm. You haven't done anything as hard. So it's like you've pulled back before you've gone to the edge, so it's easier to sort of regret it and purify it.
Could that preparation be just in your mind? Or does it have to be actual actions?
This is, I think, probably a difference between the... certainly with malice and covetousness and wrong view, that is entirely mental. with killing or other probably in this school it would have to be the actual physical preparations, but you know, might be like sort of wheedling yourself into that position where you can say that nasty thing that you've always wanted to say.
Friends or family member will accustomed to using English language, like I'm killing this guy, I really want to kill, but verbally, how do you help them to see this kind of, you know, this really cause bad result?
I didn't entirely.
So like if your friends or your family member using the language, you keep saying that, I want to kill this guy, you know. Wasn't really intend to kill, but it's kind of like a
expressive,
verbal.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do you handle that as a bystander?
I think that the best way to, I mean, it is a common, you know, expression in English and in other languages also, you know, I feel like I could kill him, you know. People say that I really want to throttle him or something, you know. I think the best way to deal with it is to develop your own compassion and patience. And the more you develop your own compassion and patience, then you'll find a way to say something that'll either diffuse the situation or help them. You might find the right way. You know, you might sometimes just laughing and say, oh yeah, it's so frustrating. If you say it, if you laugh and say it's so frustrating in the right way, it might just completely diffuse their feeling. And then at some point you might be in a position where you can give them some advice. You can say, you know, it's not good to be like that. You shouldn't do that. It's not so good. It's not that bad, but it's really better to try to be nicer in your speech. And then if you can give them that sort of advice at some point, then that's fine. But the main thing is the more you develop your own love and compassion, then somehow a situation where you might be able to make an effect will come up. Whereas if you don't meditate upon that, then you'll just end up sounding overbearing. Yeah?
Is there ever a way that you can cancel out bad karma? Like,
yeah,
if you do good work now, that you would cancel out bad karma that you did in previous lives?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's called confession practice. We touched on it this morning when we talked about the four powers, the power of regret, the power of the support, the power of the antidote, and the power of resolve. And basically, if you regret what you've done, you basically confess it and promise not to do it again. And you do this with the support of like a great being or the Buddhas or the Bodhisattvas or a Buddha statue or something. Then you can confess it and purify it. And there are also, you can, in the preliminary practices, there's the practice of Vajrasattva, but there are also other things you can do. You can recite the sutra in three sections, which is in the Kaji Munlam book. Just read that through in English or Tibetan or whatever. And think to yourself that as you're doing it, you're confessing. And that's a way to confess it. So karma is not necessarily, even if it's what's called here definite karma, that doesn't mean that you can't purify it.
So this is the past lives where you don't remember what you did wrong, but
exactly.
Sure,
yes. You can be pretty sure. In fact, we don't even remember all the bad things we've done in this life. Yes.
I was thinking about your comment about Fluffy. So ideally, house pets, we should just allow them to die naturally.
Palliative care would be good. Palliative care. Make them comfortable as you can.
I know there's that saying that, you know, when you put them out of their suffering, I mean, that's
the motivation. You just don't know what suffering they're getting into next.
Right.
And it's just inherently, I mean, it's something, it's what we do in this culture. We don't consider killing animals really to be bad in this culture. Hunting, killing, you know, killing animals, eating, you know, breeding livestock and then slaughtering it, butchering it and all that. Not considered bad in this culture. And it probably comes out of the Judeo-Christian idea that it's only killing beings who have souls, that is, fellow humans, that has any negative consequence. But in Buddhism, we don't accept the existence of a soul, and so don't see the difference. Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about the relationship between karmic action done on somebody? Like, if you beat somebody, is there a relationship between the person you beat and you beating them? Is there some kind of a karmic connection between the two that's happening there? Or why does
there seems to be.
You know, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be some sort of a karmic connection, and there are what we call karmic creditors. It doesn't come up in this explanation. Karmic creditors. People you've done something to who are going to get you back in the future. You've got the debt. You killed them in the past, and they're going to get you back. So there is talk of that, particularly if you read the life stories of the Buddha and the past lives of the Buddha. There are lots of stories about beings being connected from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. And often it comes through karmic, you know, having done something. You know, the king who killed the Dharma teacher, what is his name in Sanskrit? Middle Dadze. Pushpa, I don't remember his name in Sanskrit. Anyway, beautiful flower, beautiful moon flower, Chandraprabhakumara. So he killed Chandraprabhakumara. Chandraprabhakumara was born as Gampopa. The king who killed him was the Shakyamuni Buddha. Connections, you know. The other, and so another lifetime, there was another king who killed another Dharma teacher. That Dharma teacher was the Shakyamuni Buddha, and the king was Katyana Putra. So there are connections that are made from lifetime to lifetime. So we have individual streams, but we seem to get tangled up in each other. Amy?
I've been thinking for a couple of years now about eating meat, which I do. And one thing I was wondering about is this notion of collective guilt.
Mm.
So I have a lot of, well, not a lot, but I have several friends who raise meat.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend this summer say, do you want to go in on a cow with us? You know, which I would have done without thinking 2 years ago, probably. And I have a friend who raises meat and has put a lot of effort into figuring out how to kill it so that it suffers the least possible amount. And the animals are well treated, they're happy, you know, they rotational grazing, and then, you know, he's really, like, studied to ensure, you know, and will tell me with eminent pride, you know, like, these lambs feel less than a second or something, you know, and they don't know what's going to happen to them, and, mm-hmm. you know, so I'm thinking about that versus, you know, I can go to the supermarket, I can buy meat that's been raised on a feedlot in Iowa on corn where the animals suffer tremendously mm-hmm. in their lives. But I'm farther away and the death of that animal, but I feel like mm-hmm. the way my friend Chuck, like, if he kills that animal, he's taking that karma, whereas don't I share some karma? If I go to the supermarket and buy this feedlot meat, it's farther removed. I'm farther removed from the death, but I feel a lot worse about eating that meat, because I feel like that. I guess what I'm asking you is, I feel like when some of these rules of karma were laid down, there wasn't, like, feedlot industrial meat production.
If you are, if you rejoice in the death of the animal, in the killing of the animal, it's wonderful that that animal was killed because now I can have some meat, basically, or even some less. Then you are getting the karma of that. if your friend Chuck kills the animal, I'm killing this animal for Amy, and then you accept the meat, you get the bad karma of that kill. If he kills it, and then you happen to eat the meat, you are not getting the bad karma of that. If he kills it for you and you eat it, if he says, "Oh, Amy's coming over for dinner, let's have fresh lamb,"
or if I order a lamb for him,
you order a lamb, you're killing. You order the lobster, you're killing. You know.
But to what extent is it better for me to actually do that and accept that karma versus going to the supermarket and buying pork or lamb or beef that I know suffered tremendously? And yeah, it's out of sight, and I don't have to look at it. But all kinds of environmental degradation and systems of transportation, feedlot agriculture, and torture. You know, you see these videos online of these animals that are.
Yeah, yeah, no. It's.
Chuck,
he doesn't do any of that, but he still kills them. He still kills them. The people who are running the feedlots deserve a special compassion because not only do they have the bad karma of killing, they have the bad karma of mistreating the animals for their entire lives as well. So they deserve a special compassion. And that lamb may only feel a second of pain, but it doesn't want to lose its life. It's still killing. Sorry.
What about lobster?
They get a lot of compassion. Very hard. Repeated, as we said, what makes ripening of karma is strong intention, being continuous. Lobster men, they're going to get boiled, unfortunately. You know. This is the hard part about karma. A lot of the things we do, and this is why so many teachers are really encouraging the Dalai Lama, the Gyalon Karma, but really encouraging people to be a vegetarian. Because it causes so much suffering. Even eggs. Free-range eggs, you know, the chickens are really put to a lot of... The free-range eggs, the chickens are okay, but, you know, then there's a rooster there. So there's a being, so there's a good chance that there is a being inside that egg. With the industrial eggs, where the chickens are, they're stuffed in these tiny cages where they can hardly move, because if they're given any room, they'll peck each other to death. You know, a lot of suffering there. So, but these are really things that you have to think about. And I'm not going to say you have to become vegetarian. But I will strongly advise you not to eat food that is killed on your behalf, not to order a pig or a sheep or whatever, thinking, okay, I'll put them in the freezer when they're done, because you will have the karmic effects of that. From a karmic standpoint, going to the supermarket is better, but it's not good for the animals, and so... Eating the flesh of an animal that's already been killed, or of a human that's already been killed, is not in itself bad, karmically. It's participating in the process of killing that's hard. And the closer you are into it, related to it, you're going to get the karma. So, some people have to eat a little bit of meat. But if you try to keep it to a minimum, that would be best. Bob, you had a question, then I think we'll call it.
But it's not hopeless, is it? Because wasn't it Milarepa that was a murderer? And do I have it right?
Yeah.
So even when you're a murderer, you can become an enlightened being.
Right.
With a lot of hard work. So.
Yeah, a lot of hard work.
I'm hopeless sitting here, because we've done a lot of bad things.
We've done a lot of bad things. But okay. What is it that got Milarepa... How did Milarepa turn from being the sorcerer who murdered 35 people into being a Buddha? He understood karma. He understood that what he had done was going to bring him horrific results in the future. He really thought about this. And he realized he was going to die, and when he died, he would experience the results of the evils that he'd done. And so then he was really diligent. He cut the ties to this life. And he had no pleasure for honor again. He went to the mountains. He sat in the mountains retreat praying, may I die in the mountain retreat, and did his practice, had complete faith and devotion in his guru. He was undistracted, and he was able to realize the inseparability of samsara and nirvana. So it is, we've got hope. But we have to, first of all, we have to realize that the actions that we've done are going to have consequences, and so we need to take care of them. And then we have to actually do it. So we've got a chance. You know, we've got the precious human birth. We're here. We can do it. But we have to actually do it. So now I think maybe it's time for tea. Thank you very much. Actually, it's time for the dedication prayers. The first the Day Watch End prayer we'll sing at once, and then the Long Life prayers.